Hello and welcome to another episode of ICU Doc Talk. Today I think I'm going to talk about communicating in a medical setting. And this is, I know it's kind of vague and it's going to be very broad. It's just going to be kind of random, but I'm going to share some stories about encounters of communication or poor communication that I've had through my career and training. I think this is intended for trainees, you know, if you're a med student or a resident, as you grow through your training, and just everybody, you know, anybody you work in healthcare. I also want to talk about like the safety of communication, why it's so important, and just how to communicate clearly and succinctly, and what to communicate in certain scenarios. So this will just be kind of a random thing, but I think it'll be useful. Let's do it. All right, I'm going to start out sharing a story from when I was a resident, and it might not be clear why I'm telling the story to begin with, but I'll get to the moral or whatever afterwards. Okay, so I was a senior anesthesia resident, okay, and I was giving a break, meaning I was going around to different operating rooms giving breaks to my fellow residents or nurse anesthetists, lunch breaks, right? So that in anesthesia we can exchange out and give each other breaks like that. So I went to a room, and it was an orthopedic room, and I got a brief sign out from my co-resident and sent him or her to lunch. And then the case was just beginning, some sort of orthopedic case, which I barely remember what it was, but I know it was orthopedic. And it was the beginning of the case, right? So we had induced anesthesia, put in a breathing tube and stuff like that. And at the beginning of the case, we have this like pre-op checklist where we go over, you know, the surgical staff and the anesthesia staff, we go over, it's like a checklist. Okay, we've done this, this, and this. You know, it's like a safety checklist. Very common in lots of institutions. So in the safety checklist, we are going off, you know, okay, here's what we'll give for antibiotics. Here's what we'll give for pain control, things like that. And the orthopedic surgeon, the main attending, is going over these things. And during this, I was like, oh, should we do a post-op nerve block? And I didn't know the surgeon. I don't think I'd ever worked with her. I don't even know who she is now. I can't remember her name. I didn't know her before. I don't know her afterwards. And I was like, should we do a post-op pain block? And she was like, why are you bringing that up right now? Like very annoyed that I interrupted her. And I was like, it's literally, and I definitely had attitude saying this, definitely attitude. I was like, it's literally in the post pre-op in this checklist that you're doing right now. And I pointed to it and it said on the checklist, like, you know, should a post-op block be considered? I was like, it's right there. This is the exact time we should be talking about this. So it was a little bit of a confrontation, right? And she was not satisfied with that. And she was definitely annoyed with me. And I was annoyed with her. And then she was like, what? And then we kept going through the checklist. And she was like, what allergies does this patient have? And I was like, let me double check. Now, I was giving a break in this room, right? And I turned to the computer screen and I looked at what the patient's allergy were. And there were like three of them. And I said, oh, they're this, this, and this. And I read them off the screen. I didn't know the allergies off the top of my head. And then we went on with the case and that was fine. And my resident came back to come back and I left the room, right? That was the interaction. Okay. So later in this same day, an anesthesiologist, an attending anesthesiologist, comes up to me, right? Who I've known through my residency, a great, really, really great guy, who I admire, and I think he's an older anesthesiologist, and he's like, comes up to me, and he's like, so I heard I forget the substance of the conversation, but he was basically like, I heard, what was your interaction in this room with that orthopedic surgeon? And as soon as he was like talking, I was like, as soon as he approached me, I was like, oh. She went and complained about me. The surgeon went and complained about me, right? So I was like, oh, I immediately knew what this conversation was about to be like. I was about to be reprimanded. So I knew that right away. Now, and just for context, like, I had a good relationship with this anesthesiologist. I was not a problem child resident, right? I was a chief resident. Like, I was not worried about being reprimanded. but I knew exactly what was about to happen. I knew what this conversation was about. So he was like, you know, she complained that you didn't know the allergies for the patient, you know. I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, oh, I understand. She's trying to get me in trouble. She nitpicked, and I knew this was happening, and this is definitely what happened. She nitpicked that I didn't know the patient's allergies off the top of my head which is not that unusual, to be honest. Right, in an operating room, if there's 4, 5, 6 cases throughout that day, not that, and there's one anesthesia provider, that anesthesia provider is not likely going to know every single allergy for every single patient off the top of their head. They may have to use a mental, reminder, like looking at the patient's chart. Anyway, so she didn't like the interaction. She didn't like that I brought up that post-op pain block. She didn't like that. She nitpicked something and she went to go get me in trouble. Very clear. And I knew that's exactly what happened like 2 seconds into this conversation. Okay. So that's not why I'm telling this story. I'm not telling this story to complain about the surgeon. I swear I'm going to get to my point. And it's a good point. I think it's worth considering. So I'm like, okay, this is a conversation. I recognize it. This is a conversation where I'm going to get reprimanded for this interaction with this surgeon. I'm a trainee. I'm a resident. And I'm getting reprimanded by an attending anesthesiologist in my program, right? Understanding what kind of conversation you're having in medicine is very important. Understanding power hierarchies is also important, unfortunately. I wish it weren't. I don't like power hierarchies, but these things do matter. They impact interaction and communication, right? So, I mean, I forgot the substance of the rest of this conversation, but, you know, what I could have said, I didn't do this, right? Here would have been the wrong thing to do. I remember saying like, oh yeah, she was annoyed because I brought these things up. But then I was like, I'll try to do better next time. You know, I get it. I should have known, right? I played the role of someone being reprimanded, right? Which was the right thing. It was the expedient political thing for me to do, right? If I had been, it would have been easy for me to be like, hey, Dr. So-and-so, the anesthesiologist I was talking to, do you know the allergies of all the patients of the rooms you're covering right now off the top of your head? Right? I could have said that. He wouldn't have known them. Right? If I had been like, do you know the allergies of all your patients right now that are in the ORs? Because he was covering several rooms right at that moment. If I said, do you know the allergies of them? And I knew he wouldn't have been able to say that. I'm like, so why am I being reprimanded for this? Right? I could have done that easily. What would that have done for me? That would not have been good for me. Because and this is my main point. Being defensive in medicine is bad. Having a defensive attitude, I think, is often bad. Now, that's easy for me to say, right? So I was a chief resident and I was well, like, thought of, and I didn't have any problems or anything like that. So, but if I had a pattern, let's say, and I'm also, man, now I'm getting complicated into the weeds and stuff. I'm also like, you know, a white guy. You know, I don't really face discrimination in my life, never really have. So take what I'm saying with a grain of salt, right? If I look different or different, or if I was a woman in medicine, you know, there can be chronic discrimination against people like that don't look like me, and maybe they need to be defensive. But I think take this advice with a grain of salt. If in this type of situation, to be defensive, you only reinforce the bad image that someone is trying to create about you, right? So, because I knew exactly what happened. That orthopedic surgeon was trying to get me in trouble because she didn't like me. She didn't like that interaction that we had, and she was trying to punish me by trying to make me look irresponsible or negligent or something like that. So if I had gotten defensive, that would have only reinforced what she was trying to do. Is that making sense? That is my point of telling this story. You need to understand what kind of conversation is happening. And sometimes it's the expedient thing for you to play that part and to move on. Now, injustices and indignation happen all the time in our work lives, right? Politics are involved in our careers and our work. And I think it's important to know where you're at in your training. What is the long game? What is your role? What is the expedient thing for you to do? And then what is the right thing for patients as well, right? So should I have known those patients' allergies off the top of my head? Sure, of course. That would have been the best and safest thing for the patient to do. And that's the right attitude to have, to be like, I should have known those allergies. I'll try to do better next time. Moving on. And 5 minutes later, that anesthesiologist was like, man, he even told me, he's like, I'm really impressed with how you responded with that. Like, right. So take that story and my little moral from it take what it from you want. I don't think you can apply these things universally, but I found it to be a useful experience. I think being defensive, and that's one of my main points that I want to talk about, is defensiveness in medicine, having a defensive attitude about your actions. It all that does is just to protect your own ego. So I've said it before, and I will continue to say it, medicine is not a place for ego. Unfortunately, ego is there. For one thing, we all have ego, right? You don't deny that you don't have an ego. Everybody has an ego, right? I'm literally talking to myself in a podcast for people to listen to me. I have an ego, right? Everybody has ego. And for better or worse, right? You got to have some ego, I think, to get out of bed. But defensiveness in medicine is only for your own ego, oftentimes. And it doesn't help you. It doesn't help your patients. It doesn't help a collaborative working environment. So what I mean by this, you see it all the time. There's these little micro defensive responses that happen all the time. You see them almost every day in interactions, communicating with people, communicating. So wherever it is that you work, say you're giving report to somebody, like you're signing out, and you're like, hey, I have this patient. We did this, 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 and this. And the person's like, oh, you started you gave a beta blocker. And then if your response is, well, we gave a beta blocker because of this, trying to explain your reasoning, when simply that person is just reciting facts, but you take it as like, oh, I need to explain myself. You see it all the time when people feel compelled to explain themselves, when people weren't asking you to explain yourself. You're just trying to recite what's going on, right? Now, this is a big thing when it comes to M&M conferences, morbidity and mortality, you may have heard of in medicine, right? Morbidity and mortality conferences are a way for that happen in disciplines all across medicine. When patients die or they have bad complications, it is very good and healthy to have a conference where you talk about specific cases so that you can all, it's not meant to be punitive. Although sometimes it functionally can be that way, and that's not a good environment, right? That's a toxic work environment. But the point of M&M is to present things that happened, to not assign blame, because blame is weird, right? Blame is a weird thing in medicine. Medicine, a patient going through a hospital, say they're getting surgery, think how many things are involved in that patient's care. And then if there's a complication, something went wrong, it's usually a series of events. Right? It's rarely just one person making a negligent mistake. Now, that does happen. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. And usually, you know, morbidity and mortality, it's about everybody learning from those events and learning about them all along, you know, from every point in the system, from the individual point to the system as a whole. That's the point of having a conference like this, so you can all learn in a disimpassioned way. It's not to be culpable, and it's not to be defensive, right? So what my advice is, you know, I do it all the time, right? You feel this need to explain yourself. You don't need to explain yourself. I mean, maybe, rarely, but usually I don't really know. I'm losing my train of thought, but this need to explain your actions, that comes from a defensive urge to defend your ego and to not assign blame to yourself. And I don't think it's helpful for you. I don't think it looks good when people do that. I think just accept the fate of medicine and, you know, that happens to people and that you were just one cog in that wheel. Okay, I'm going to share another story. This is when I was an intern and I was on ENT service, right? ENT are ear, nose, throat doctors. Most people not in medicine don't know what ENT surgeons actually do. For one thing, they don't really know they're surgeons. They are. They're amazing surgeons. I love ENT surgeons. They're like one of my favorite specialties to work with. And they do lots of stuff, ear, nose, and throat, all over the place. Neck, they do incredible, incredible surgeries. So I was on the ENT service, right? So I was in the operating room, helping out with surgeries. I was taking care of post-surgical patients and right, very busy, very exhausting. And I was the intern, right? It's my first year. That internship is that year between residency and medical school where you're really learning how to be a doctor. And it's very exhausting, very difficult time. And you learn a lot, you grow a lot. So there was a medical student on the service and And then I had a senior residence, you know, in charge of the service that I worked with every day. And we were rounding, and we rounded on a patient who had had a mandibular resection of cancer. There's this surgery that ENT surgeons do, where if someone has like cancer of their jaw, they resect part of that jaw out, and then they take your fibula bone, which is in your leg, they take it out of your leg and they put it in your jaw. They like graft it in as like a new jaw, right? It's an amazing surgery. This patient had already had that surgery done, right? So they had had fibula bone removed and they had a cast around their leg. Another part of the surgery is that they take a skin graft from the thigh as part of this reconstruction in the mouth. So this patient had a cast in their leg, and then they also had this like patch, medical patch over this skin graft that was stapled in, okay? The senior resident looked at me and said, later today, can you take that patch, that skin graft on the thigh? And I was like, of course. That's a basic thing to do, right? Just staple, remove, or you just take it out. So later that day, the medical student is like, what can I do for you? What can we do? Is there anything I can do? And I said, oh yeah, you know that patient we're talking about? Go, you know, on their thigh, go remove that graft, that patch from their thigh with a, you know, with a staple remover. And that's a very easy thing to do. Removing staples from a patient is a thing a medical student certainly knows how to do. And that was fine. About an hour later, senior resident comes to me and he was like, why did you remove the cast from this patient's leg? And I was like, what? And this patient was fresh post-op, right? Their leg was cast. They were like 1 day post-op. So that cast is supposed to stay on the leg for a couple weeks. And I was like, I didn't do that. Turns out the medical student did it. The medical student was confused and they took shears and they removed the cast from the patient's leg rather than that little patch on their thigh. It was a big deal, right? This was a big like miscommunication and it was a big problem that the cast was removed. The patient turned out to be fine. Everything was fine. So I had, you know, now me in this position, how do I respond to this? Now I bring up the story because things like this happen, complications, miscommunications happen. How do you respond? What do you do when you're the person in the hot seat being blamed, right? Number one is don't assign blame to an individual right away. Right? That's for later. If there needs to be a root cause analysis and all that stuff, and it needs to be assigned, like, okay, why did this happen? Oh, it was this individual. That's for later. But to right off the bat, if I were like, it wasn't me, it was a med student. That, I don't know. That just doesn't look good on you when you do that. It doesn't look good on anybody to just immediately So for one thing, it wasn't just a med student's fault, right? It was also my fault for not communicating properly, for not knowing if that med student had ever done something like that before, right? And then it was the entire team's fault. You know, this is what I'm saying. It's a system. It's the team. It's a collaborative effort. And when something like happens, everybody should take that hit together and consider together. You should not assign blame to an individual, even though one individual may have done the thing. It's a systems thing. Understand why it happened. Try not to be defensive. Try not to assign blame, cast that blame away. Try to get those icky, terrible emotions out of it. Be dispassionate. Try to understand why it happened and be compassionate to everybody that's involved with it. Because everybody, you know, in medicine, we're all here. We all show up. We're all trying to do what's best for patients. And we all make mistakes, right? That's kind of one of my main points here is, medicine is a human-run institution, right? We have lots of machines and protocols and stuff like that, but it's still human-run. And if you have something that is human-run, you will have human error. So doing root cause analysis and be like, oh, it was this person that did this thing. Oh, what can we do forward to avoid that? Now, I'm not saying that's bad to do that, but I'm just saying you cannot get medical complications and error out of medicine because humans are running it, and we make cognitive errors. It is human nature. It is a fundamental part of what we are. We will make mistakes. And that maybe that mistake will be you one of these days. Maybe it has been you that you're listening to it and you feel awful about it, but you're human, right? You're going to make mistakes. You're going to have cognitive errors. It will happen. It will probably happen again. And it's just, and unfortunately, sometimes our errors, because we are, we have, we're, rather than dealing with, you know, mechanical parts in an engine making error, we are dealing with human beings and their bodies. And sometimes our fallibilities and those mistakes impact patients and can harm them and can kill them. These things can happen. That is an inherent part of medicine, unfortunately. Okay, I have another really great story that just happened recently. I love that. I love this. It's a very simple story. So I had a patient in my operating room who was bleeding out, losing lots of blood very quickly. So we had brought in these pressure bags to give blood very rapidly, right? We put blood products in these pressure bags so that blood transfuses as quick as possible into the patient, because the patient was actively bleeding. This is in the operating room, the patient was getting surgery. So there's a lot of people in the room. There's, you know, when crises like this happen, you know, it's not just me, the anesthesiologist. We had, I think there was another colleague anesthesiologist and then several nurse anesthetists in the room. I think there was two residents in there. Like things were crashing. And a nurse anesthetist was hanging up blood and was changing it out to give more blood. And she was changing out the tubing, which was full of blood, transfused blood. And she accidentally forgot to do a clip on the tubing, and she released it, and blood went flying in the room, and it went in one direction and it just covered another nurse anesthetist like from head to toe. She's just covered in a bunch of saline mixed with transfused blood, just like all of her scrubs. And I was standing right there. It almost hit me, but I was out of the path. Anyway, and I looked at the nurse anesthetist who just got hit with all the blood, and she was like, "What?" She looked down at herself, right? Like trying to understand what had just happened. And there was this pause, right? And you very understandably, you know, here's what she did. She looked at the other nurse anesthetist who had accidentally sprayed her with blood, and very sincerely, not ironically, not being mean, she said, "What can I help you with?" And she was totally sincere. She's like, what can I help you with this? It was an amazing interaction, right? It was incredible. What an amazing, amazing, amazing response to getting showered in blood, right? You could be angry, of course. The immediate response is going to be like outrage and being angry and like, "Hey, you idiot, how could you do this? What is..." Now, I work with really, really great people, exceptionally great people. Nurse anesthetists, my anesthesiologist colleagues, my surgical colleagues, just, I work in a very good culture. Not everybody has good cultures. I'm fortunate to work in a really great culture. So I was actually not surprised by this interaction, just because I work in such a great culture. But it still just left such an impression on me. Like, that person was like, "Oh, this happened because somebody needs some support. So I'm going to support them." Ah, it was just amazing. I'll never forget it. It was awesome. And I told her that. I was like, I stopped her and I was like, "Your response here was absolutely phenomenal." Okay. Another thing I just want to talk about, this is just random, is doing sign outs in medicine. Okay. So for those that, you know, if you're not medical, so a sign out, I mean, it's obvious what it is. So like, you know, shift change, someone's going home and you have a bunch of patients in your care and somebody else is coming on the night team. You need to sign out information to them about a whole ICU or a whole floor of medicine patients or patients that were in clinic or whatever it is. You need to sign out to them. So what is sign out? It is conveying essential, concise information for that provider who's coming on. Now, I've done many, many sign outs in my career, right? One of my main points is that sign outs need to be concise. I just remember when I was an intern and I was on a pediatric rotation, right? I love pediatricians. I am not one of them, meaning I am not that personality type. They're extremely meticulous. Not all, of course, I'm generalizing. But pediatricians are very meticulous. They're very fastidious. They're very detail-oriented, as they should be. This is not me being critical. Those sign-outs, inpatient pediatric patients, just to sign out to the night team, they would take an hour or more just to convey information. So I guess now I'm being a little bit critical. That was too much. That's too much information in a sign out. You do not, you should not take an hour to sign out patients. This is just my opinion. Okay, I'm very happy to be challenged on this. It's too much information. That's information overload. You should not be, for one thing, wasting people's time conveying all the information. I don't know what the point of that is. And how much do you think a person's going to retain giving all the information? And it's a distraction from the actual pertinent information that they need. I actually think it hampers and it gets in the way of the sign out when you're giving tons of extraneous information that doesn't matter. Maybe it doesn't matter, but it's not pertinent. It's not pertinent. I think signouts should be brief. They should be concise. And you can't, here's the thing, and it's a skill, by the way, right? This takes time to develop. So if you're a medical school student listening to this, it's a skill. It's just like rounding, right? Distilling information in a concise, thoughtful way takes practice and skill and time and experience to be good at that. But they should be concise and just containing pertinent information for that provider who's coming on so that they know and like what are backup plans and conditions. Now, to do this, you must know your patients well, right? If you don't know your patients well, it's hard to have a concise sign out. If the patients you've been taking care of, if all the information has just been sitting on a paper all day and you haven't really been caring for them, now that can happen when in understaffing, right? If someone's covering like 30 plus patients throughout the day or night, of course they can't know everything about every patient. They have to rely on a piece of paper or whatever. That's not their fault, right? That's a staffing issue. But I'm just saying, if you know your patients well and you have a global picture of them, you can give a brief sign out. And I actually think you should. It should be concise, right? So I sign out. Same goes for note writing. I think if you're writing a Shakespearean play for every note, you don't need to do that. You're wasting your time. Your time is too valuable for that. And again, these are just my opinions. Your time is too valuable. You shouldn't be wasting time dictating and writing huge, long, eloquent notes. You should convey the concise, pertinent information that is needed that is needed for the complexity of that patient, right? Sometimes I write notes that are very long, rarely, because patients are very complex. Sometimes they're very brief. My note that I'm putting in a chart is not there to impress people with how long a note is, right? They should be concise. Now, I guess take that with a grain of salt as well. If you're a medical student, your notes, or a resident, your notes are probably being highly scrutinized, maybe a little more, by people that are evaluating your performance, right? This is another reason that med school education is so flawed, right? Because you are behaving in a way that is you're trying to impress, and it may not actually be good medicine. You're just trying to show that you're a team player and you're a cheerleader, and right? Anyway, I think signouts and conveying medical information should be concise. It should be pertinent. All right, I could share many, many more stories, and I have many, many more thoughts about how to communicate in medicine. But I think that's all I've got for the moment. Let's talk about some books. I'll talk about a nonfiction and a fiction. I'll start with a nonfiction book. The first one is a recent release. It's called The Anxious Generation: How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. This is by Jonathan Haidt. And it's the first book I've read by him. This came out March 26th of this year, 2024. It's 400 pages. I've been aware of this author, but I haven't read anything. He wrote a book called The Coddling of the American Mind, which I've been hesitant to read because I thought maybe I wouldn't agree with it, which is not a reason to not read something. I read books all the time I don't agree with. I'm going to get into... So I did overall like this book, but I had problems with it too. So as a parent of a young child, I really read this book with a lot of interest. So it's about this quote-unquote great rewiring that was inflicted on Gen Z between 2010 and 2015 that completely, as the author, believes, upended Gen Z from a normal childhood and caused a generational mental health crisis. Now, that is debatable, right? But in my opinion, I think the author does a good job of explaining himself with with good statistics and makes a compelling case against a phone-based childhood and praises the virtue of a play-based childhood. I think this book was good overall, but I didn't agree with everything. And I think some of his reason is actually fallacious when it comes to what he refers to as helicopter parenting, which I'm going to get into. So depression, self-harm, and anxiety are undoubtedly higher in Gen Z and have a sharp rise in boys and girls in 2010 and thereafter. That's a fact. Now, what is the cause? That's the controversy, right? Now, one could speculate that these children grew up after the 9/11 era and after the 2008 financial crisis with high unemployment. And as the author argues, which I agree with, every generation has socioeconomic upheaval, but it doesn't always typically result in dramatic drop in mental health. Now, maybe mental health has just been underreported in prior generations. That's also a fair point. For me, I agree the most likely and obvious explanation is that their childhood became steeped in toxic self-comparisons on social media, which affects girls more than boys, and video game and pornography addiction, which affects boys more than girls. Social media is a strategic, asynchronous, disembodied interaction with the aims of fostering and protecting an individual self-brand. Right, social media platforms are the most efficient conformity machines ever invented, where a user can literally gauge their approval by numerical likes and views. This is really bad for everybody. We all know it. We can all feel it. Okay. And I think it's bad for adults. For me, it can only be worse for children. When a child starts doing this around the age of 10, they chase that dopamine hit of views and likes and sink the enormous opportunity cost of real-life social interactions and development that prepare them for adulthood. Social media doesn't just correlate with poor mental health. The author argues that it causes it. I don't know if he proves that, but I think he makes a good case for it. He goes into that children have a defend mode and they have a discovery mode. Both are useful, but the former, defend mode, gets engaged more with a phone-based childhood. Free and unsupervised play foster the discovery mode, where children learn how to navigate not only their three-dimensional space, but relationships and their own feelings. A phone-based childhood constantly puts a child in defend mode, which spills over to real life with chronic anxiety. Social media inflicts sleep deprivation and social deprivation, along with attention fragmentation and addiction. Across the board, that's not just children, right? That happens to adults. These things are awful already on a socialized adult. Imagine the cost on a child's mind that has many years to go before proper adult brain development, which doesn't happen until you're into your 20s. According to the author, there are real gender differences between boys and girls, which are almost certainly sociogenic, meaning they're culturally created, which I agree with. And these differences account for the disparate impact of a phone-based childhood on boys and girls. Girls strive for communion and relationship building. Of course, I'm generalizing, but I do think it's generally this is true, where boys strive for self-autonomy and actualization. These culturally programmed desires, I believe, are functionally very real. The author talks about how girl aggression is relational, which explains why social media impacts them more than for boys. You take all the self-comparison to airbrush models on magazine covers from like the 70s and 80s that girls were dealing with then. Now put that on hyperdrive, socialize it over screen, add cyberbullying and a dopamine addiction, and you will have very sad, lonely, and anxious girls. For boys, video games can fragment their socialization and silo it off into asynchronous relationships that then addict and hamper their growth. And then the easy access to pornography, while impacting both boys and girls, seems to hit boys harder than consume them at a very, very early age. So there's a lot of controversy, like, oh, I don't think he proved everything. Now, you do need to be careful with books like this that just present statistics, and it's not a peer-reviewed, you know, study, right? For me, it seems pretty obvious that early social media and screen time, it has bad effect. You know it. I mean, as you know, adults know that too much time doing these things. I'm not saying they're bad all the time. They're bad, but adults doing these things too much obviously induce an addictive behavior. And if you do that to an immature brain, so I'm biased to believe him. I'll just tell you that I am biased towards this viewpoint. Now, here's where I have a problem with this book. The author creates a false dilemma between a play-based childhood and a phone-based childhood. These two things are not mutually exclusive, and the author likes to like act like they are and partition them off like they're the only two options. As for me, as a parent who's very involved in my child's life, I take umbrage with the term helicopter parent, which the author uses. This, I believe, well-intentioned author, he asserts many times in this book that during the 1980s, parents became overprotective and stopped letting their kids have autonomy. My first response to that is, I don't know what you're talking about. He doesn't really present a lot of evidence for that either. I thought it was kind of an overt generalization and highly speculative and very simplistic. In my opinion, having more parental presence, particularly when it comes to safety, doesn't necessarily hamper a child's socialization and growth. Now, I'm no expert, right? But I'm not joking. The author, he literally says, kids should be able to play in junkyards and with fire unsupervised. Okay, I don't agree with that. Without presenting much evidence, he talks about the statistic improbability of your child really being harmed or kidnapped. That's fine, but the stakes are enormous, right? I think it's a parent's responsibility to protect them from catastrophe, regardless of how unlikely, because the stakes are absolutely enormous. I think the author creates a false dichotomy that you either must let your children roam the streets unsupervised or put a phone in front of their faces, right? Of course, that's not true. There's an entire spectrum of parenting, one which could involve letting children roam under freeway overpasses while also sticking a phone in front of their noses for 8 hours a day, right? You can do both those things. I found his take on this really bizarre, and his assertions that parents are hampering their children's development with over-supervision mostly unsupported. I really don't like the term helicopter parenting. I think it's become a term that can be used for parents who don't actively engage with their children, right? I think the key here is family enrichment, right? If you take away a phone and social media, deprive them from a phone and social media at that at a young age, 10 to 15, but you don't replace it with good family enrichment, then that's a problem also. Like the whole point is, what kind of relationship do you have with your children? To me, that's fundamental. Anyway, the solutions the author offers, I think, are good, and they're very simple. And I already had these in mind for my child before I read this book. No social media or their own personal smartphone before the age of 16. And phone-free schools. Seems like a pretty simple solution. Difficult to implement, right? Of course. I'm not a parent of a teenager yet, so it's easy for me to say. So I get that. If your gut reaction is like, oh, you'll see. That's true, but it's feasible, right? And having phone-free schools is feasible. It's difficult, but the Waldorf schools do it, right? They have no screens in their schools. If you buy into a community whose parents, so people, you know, parents will be like, oh, but they'll feel like a social pariah because all of their parents, all of their friends have them. Well, if you are engaged in a community who has the same values, then it's a little easier to not have them addicted to a smartphone at the age of 10. You don't need to go to, you could find a co-op parenting school, you know, a homeschool of like-minded parents, right? There are ways around this. You don't have to throw up your hands and be like, the fight's over. Just throw a smartphone in front of your 10-year-old. You don't have to do that. I think you can be deliberate. Anyway, overall, I think the book was worth reading. It's called The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, Haidt. All right, I'm going to talk about fiction. I'm very excited to talk about it. Okay, it's The Dark Tower by Stephen King, book 7. I finished the series, and I loved it. I loved it. It was a hard series to get through, but I absolutely loved The Dark Tower. I think it was amazing. So I'm going to talk about this book a little bit. It will be spoiler-free up into a certain point, and then after that, I'm going to do the spoiler so you can hop off if you don't want to hear it, okay? So I still don't, after finishing this, I still don't quite know what the series is, but I know that I loved it. There are so many things I want to say about The Dark Tower, and the first is this. I loved it. I liked it. I hated it. I loathed it. I wanted to leave it behind at times, but the summation of all my emotions from this utterly insane and wonderful story is that I loved it. And I love it in a unique, weird Dark Tower way, unlike how I feel about other series. The Dark Tower is one of the most unique and amazing tales I've ever read. I can guarantee you've never read anything like it. Does it mean it's for everybody? No, it's not. But if you want to take this series for a spin, I suggest you read to the end of the third book, which was The Wastelands, before deciding to put it down. So what even is it? What is this genre? For me, the simple answer is that it has no genre. Kind of like Johnny Cash. Johnny Cash is just Johnny Cash, right? He doesn't really fit into a genre. You can try to squeeze him into something, but he doesn't really fit. And that's what The Dark Tower is. It's its own thing, and nothing compares to it. If I were a force to put into a genre, I would call it fantasy, sci-fi, meta, multiverse, western, urban fantasy, found family, traveling quest, horror, and others. It's all those genres, and then it supersedes them into what can only be called the Dark Tower. And the best thing about the series, what makes it the insanity, because it's insane, what makes it work is the core characters. Roland, Susanna, Eddie, Jake, and Oi. It's a found family that brings desperately needed cohesion to a multiverse going on in the background. Roland of Gilead is officially one of my favorite literary characters. He's brutal with his integrity, and he's flawed in such a way that it is fatal to him. I mean, a fatal flaw, but it's ultimately benefits everybody else. And then there's Eddie, the reformed junkie who has so much growth, and Susanna is possibly, she might be my favorite character in the book. In the last leg of this book, she really, really shined. And then the relationship between Jake and Roland was just amazing. It was amazing. The world is a multiverse, and it's so enthralling to see the twists and turns and contortions of the reality. The mid-world, in particular, and its amalgamation of Western American culture is really fun and engaging. The vernacular that Stephen King comes with just kept me turning the pages. Like, cry pardon and thank ya, and this whole vernacular just opened the world up. It really works for me. And then there's just so many bizarre creatures and robots and machines and corporations and it's constant spillover. It's a mess. Does it all make sense? Not likely. Did I enjoy it? Yes. The weird thing about this book is the plot of the entire series is not particularly well crafted. King took a big weakness of this story, which is basically just stream of conscious writing, and he turned it into a big strength. He knows the story is a mess, and the reader also knows it's a mess. Okay? It's very clear that just random crap just made up, that he just made it up and on the fly, and he put it into the book. But he's faithful to that nonsense imagery that he pulls out of nowhere, and then he weaves it into the story. It makes it all work because he doesn't let go of it. The whole story came very close, and I think did commit deus ex machina, right? But for me, the story works. He gets away with it because it's not so much about the plot, but about what the characters are doing with that plot. So I really recommend it. I'm going to get into the ending, okay? So if you don't want to hear it, this is spoiler for the whole series. Do not listen. Okay, I'm going to just talk about it starting right now. Okay, so if you've read the book, you finish it, it would be justified feeling that Mordred dying from like dysentery and having a very brief showdown with a tiny weird dog and just a bullet from Roland was a letdown. Even the death at the hands of the baby Mordred of the notorious Randall Flagg was also anticlimactic. The Crimson King literally being erased by some guy who only shows up at the end, that was weak. And that's worthy of a lot of complaints. But it didn't matter to me. And why? Because the tower calls to not only Roland, but to you as the reader. The reader becomes vicariously obsessed with seeing and being in the tower. The plot conflicts for me became secondary. All you care about is the tower. King does this like really ingenious thing where he warns the reader that you don't need the ending because you won't like it. And in fact, he puts Roland's entrance into the tower as a coda and gives you final warning that you'd be happier not finding out what happens in the tower. But of course, like Roland, you have to know, and so you keep reading. And what do we find? Roland's own ego looping him back to the beginning of the story where he's chasing the Man in Black. For me, this totally worked. Why? Because Roland is not a hero. He's a tragic figure. His obsession with the tower prevents him from living a normal life. He lost Susan Delgado and the two quartets with his obsessions. But the wheel must turn because it is his fight to see the tower that saves the beam and the tower and the universe. So in this way, Roland is his own antagonist. And that's why the anticlimax with the other villains didn't bother me. He's a tragic figure and he's a sacrificial figure. Really, really awesome. Will things be different the second time around, the next time around, now that he has that horn? I don't know. But you can read the whole series again and join the loop with Roland. Anyway, I loved it. My favorite book in the series was definitely Wizard and Glass. That was a masterpiece. My least favorite was Wolves of Kala. I thought that was a terrible, boring slog. Anyway, those are my thoughts. I loved it. I don't regret reading it. And there you have it. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up. You can email me at icudrecmo@gmail.com. ICU Dr. Ecmo, ECMO@gmail.com. I'm on TikTok at ICU Doctor, Instagram ICU Doctor, TikTok. Leave a review and a rating if you have not to help this podcast grow. I don't do any advertising. I don't make any money. It is a public service which I enjoy. Thanks for joining me.